Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Dr. Daniel Dreisbach, a professor in the School of Public Affairs at American University in Washington, D.C. He earned a Doctor of Philosophy degree from Oxford University, where he studied as a Rhodes Scholar, and also obtained a Juris Doctor degree from the University of Virginia. Professor Dreisbach's research interests include the intersection of religion, politics, and law with a specific focus on the American founding. Daniel has penned and edited several books, including Thomas Jefferson and the Wall of Separation Between Church and State, Faith and the Founders of the American Republic, The Forgotten Founders on Religion and Public Life, and The Sacred Rights of Conscience. His most recent monograph is Reading the Bible with the Founding Fathers, just out last month with Oxford University Press. Daniel appeared on our show last year talking about religious rhetoric of Abraham Lincoln and frequently works with one of our favorite podcast guests, Mark David Hall, who also specializes in the study of religion in the late 18th and early 19th century. We'll link to those earlier podcasts and the writings of Professor Dreisbach over at our website, so please stop by and visit us. Finally, I should mention that Daniel is a recipient of the Scholar Teacher of the Year Award at American University, the highest faculty award given by that fine institution, and congratulations on that. Daniel, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to this.
I'm looking forward to this, too, because you wrote a really interesting book here called Reading the Bible with the Founding Fathers, and it has some interesting things in here, including something on George Washington. That's only a tidbit in there, but I want to mention to our listeners that we're recording this interview on December 19th, 2016, which is the day that the electors of the Electoral College meet to cast their votes for the President of the United States. And if everything goes according to plan, we will be uploading this podcast about a week before the swearing-in of our country's 45th president. And given that you've written some stuff about George Washington, and he was the first president to get inaugurated, I thought it would be fun if you took us back some 228 years and tell us about the role that religious rhetoric played in that very first presidential inauguration. And perhaps fill us in some of the symbolism that originated back then and that still might be lingering with us today.
Yes, well, so Washington is our first president, as you rightly note, and he has this unique opportunity to put in place practices, traditions. He's setting precedent, and he's acutely aware of the fact that almost everything he says and everything he does is going to be a precedent that later generations are going to follow. The other thing that I would mention about Washington here at the outset is that he was a man who had a keen sense of drama, of the theater, of the stage. And he often spoke of himself as an actor on a political stage. And so he's very aware of the importance of setting, the importance of entrances and exits and all those things that actors are aware of. And so we see all of these things coming together in this first inaugural in April of 1789. And it is a ceremony that he crafts together with his advisors that's bathed in religious symbolism, religious content. Now, much of this was drawn from earlier traditions. He's looking back to coronation traditions that you would have seen in England. Of course, there would have already been in place a tradition in most of the colonies with the swearing in of public officials, whether it be a governor or whether it be members of a legislature. So he's drawing on these earlier traditions, some of which he had been a part of. And so there are going to be some aspects of this ceremony that are compelled by the Constitution. There is, for example, in Article 2 of the Constitution, a requirement that a very specific oath be taken by the President of the United States, and so this is going to be at the heart of the ceremony. But he's drawing on English traditions and on the common law tradition when he chooses to put his hand on the Bible. He also, according to eyewitness accounts, upon completing the oath, bends and actually kisses the Bible. Again, this is not something that was developed or new to Washington, but it was part of an earlier tradition. There's an inaugural address. Now, that's not specifically required in the Constitution, but he gives a relatively brief address, and it is filled with religious content. He speaks at great length about the role of Providence in bringing the nation to this point in history. He reminds his fellow citizens of how God had brought them, so to speak, through the trials and tribulations of the struggle for independence in the battles with Great Britain. So in all of this, we see a tremendous emphasis placed on religion. There are events taking place beyond Washington. There are prayer services taking place, both before and after the inaugural ceremony itself. In fact, once the address was given, all of those who were present in the chambers to hear Washington give this address, they cross the street and attend a religious service. So this is a moment in American history that is filled with religious symbolism, religious ritual, and much of this tradition continues to the present day. We'll see aspects of this precedent-setting first inaugural when we see the next president installed in January of 2017.
I can understand that having a public swearing-in ceremony is very important. It helps to signify the credibility of the office and make sure that everybody can see this. It's interesting to see that it's so saturated with religiosity, because we're between the two great awakenings in American history, and a lot of people are attaching a period of rationalism to this thing. And then George Washington, many people come back and say, oh, you know, he's kind of a deist. He's not really that churchy of a guy. But nonetheless, religious rhetoric, religious symbolism really seems to be saturating this whole process.
Well, let's remind ourselves that at the very heart of this ceremony, and the only reason why we're having it in constitutional terms, is because of this requirement that there be an oath of office. Now, let's think about this for a second. An oath, or the taking of an oath, is a decidedly religious act. I don't think you'll find an 18th century moral philosopher who defines oath-taking in anything other than religious terms. Right. This is a swearing of an obligation to do something in the presence of God, and assuming that if one breaks that oath, that one will suffer divine consequences, divine punishment. So, at the very heart of the inauguration is this profoundly religious act, at least as an 18th century mind would have viewed oath-taking.
Now, you do a good job describing this throughout your book, and we're going to talk more about the importance of religion, religious symbolism, religious rhetoric as we go on here. But you also fill the book with a lot of really interesting historical details. And one of the historical details that I did not know, and I thought was just amusing, if you can put yourself back in the shoes of these folks. This is the first inauguration. You want to get everything right. But they forgot something really important. What was that?
Yes, isn't that always the way it works? You plan something down to the minute detail, and then you forget something. And that was the case in the first inauguration. And all the planning, someone had forgotten to secure a Bible suitable for the occasion. And so one of the participants in the inauguration remembered that just a few feet away was the Masonic Lodge, and there was a suitable Bible, an altar Bible, at the lodge, and someone rushed over and secured that Bible. That Bible, interestingly, still survives. It's been used in a number of subsequent inaugurations. Harding, Eisenhower, Jimmy Carter, all used that Bible in their inaugurations. You can still visit the Bible in a display there at the lodge. And so it has survived and remains a very important artifact in the history of this nation.
Yeah, I can imagine just how neat it would be to see it. But even if I ever was elected to president, just to put my hand on that, to realize that Washington at a moment in history, a very critical moment in history, also had his hand on it, would just send shivers up my spine. And that is one of the things that has lingered on through the past two centuries or so with respect to inaugurations. Are there any other religious aspects that have woven their way throughout history and still remain for presidential inaugurations?
Yes. By the way, I think it's worth reminding ourselves that most presidents have been thoughtful about a Bible that they wanted to use at an inauguration. This wasn't, it's just something that most presidents have thoughtlessly considered. And so, along with Washington's Bible, a number of presidents have taken the oath on the Bible used by Abraham Lincoln. Number have used their own family Bibles, deep with significance to their own family. And so I think that tells you a little bit about the importance of the role of the Bible, at least as new presidents have seen it, in this particular ceremony. So, of course, the tradition of giving an inaugural address continues. And virtually every president has made some religious reference, some more than others, in the course of their inauguration. Probably the most famous, most elegant of all inaugural addresses is Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural, and it's rich with references to Scripture. And in fact, he draws on themes in ways that are absolutely essential to his inaugural address. And so that part of the tradition continues. Of course, placing one's hand literally on the Bible has been a continuing tradition. There's some controversy and debate over another aspect of inaugurations, and that is most presidents in modern times, at least, have concluded the oath of office with the words, "So help me God." Now, again, this is a very ancient tradition. It's been around for hundreds of years. The requirement of actually saying those words, "So help me God," was actually woven into state statutes and the like as simply a part of the oath. Now, there's some question about whether George Washington actually uttered those words or not. We've gone to the videotape, and it's not entirely clear. Again, that's become a part of at least modern inaugurations. And, in fact, it's become a part of oath-taking in public life more generally.
Now, you've mentioned videotape there, and I had to chuckle because obviously we know there wasn't videotape, but there's metaphorically a lot of videotape that is from that area, people writing down their memoirs and recording different things in newspapers and things like that. And your recent book really is steeped in a lot of this. You really, really dug into the religious rhetoric of that era. And your book, and I mentioned it again, Reading the Bible with the Founding Fathers, not only addresses the role of the Bible in Washington's inauguration, but it really focuses broadly on how the founders in the late 18th and early 19th century used the Bible both as a literary and theological source for inspiration. And you do this to address the ongoing debate as to whether or not America was founded as a Christian nation and or on Christian principles. You've written a lot about this before. So with respect to this book, what motivated this book and what is unique and different about the use of the Bible specifically?
Well, let me just say something about the sources that I'm drawing from in this book. The first thing I think to note is that this was a very literate culture. Americans were a very literate people. They had a demand for a print culture. They read broadly. And I would suggest to you, Tony, that that goes back to the Bible. This was a Bible culture. That's not to say that everyone in America embraced biblical Christianity or Orthodox Christianity in its purest form, but this was a society that valued the Bible. Many of them learned to read with a Bible open in front of them, and so the prominence of the Bible in Protestant Christianity translates itself into American society in its being a very literate culture. And so they read newspapers. They demanded newspapers. There were sermons, and many Americans wanted those sermons to be printed and published so they could read them and study them at leisure. And so this has left to us, as now in the 21st century, a rich tradition to draw on, a rich resources that we can look at to get a sense of what was valuable to them, what were the ideas that were circulating in their time and place. Now, you raise the question of whether this was a nation founded as a Christian nation. My first response to that question, which I'm asked from time to time, is, well, what does one mean by the phrase a Christian nation? It seems to me that one could have a number of different ideas in mind. Does one mean, for example, that this is a nation that was made up of primarily Christians? Well, in that sense, it's a demographic question. And the demographics would suggest that Americans were not only overwhelmingly Christian in the late 18th century, but they were overwhelmingly Protestant. The best evidence would suggest that Americans at the in 1776, Americans of European descent were talking about approximately 98% or more would have matched that description. So in that sense, it was a nation made up of primarily Christians. Does it mean that there was an effort in some constitutional sense to make this a Christian nation in the way that we see in some European countries at this point in history? The answer is probably no. In some sense, there was an effort to recognize the distinct place of the civil state from that of the church. We see that in our constitutional tradition. It's reflected, for example, in the First Amendment. So in that sense, one might say, no, it was not intended to be a Christian nation. But this is, I think, a difficult question, and you have to start with definitions. What do we mean by a Christian nation? And one of the things that draws me to this topic, and one of the things that I find interesting, is that it seems clear to me that Americans at the end of the 18th century, at this time that we often call the founding era, they were drawing on many diverse intellectual traditions. They were familiar with, they studied, they had lived under English constitutionalism. They were reading more and more about Enlightenment liberalism, the influence of thinkers like a Hobbes and Locke, for example. They were increasingly interested in ideas of republicanism that they read in the classics and the ancients, as well as rearticulations of republicanism as they read them in the works of, let's say, a Machiavelli or a Sidney. So they were drawing on a lot of different intellectual sources. And in my reading of this literature, the primary sources, it seemed to me that another one of these sources, a very important source, was the biblical tradition. And yet, when one reads the scholarly literature in our own time about the American founding, much emphasis is given to these other traditions and how they informed political thought in late 18th century America. And yet there's relatively little discussion of the influence of that biblical tradition. And so one of the things that prompted me to write this book was to simply add this other element to the body of ideas, to the broad range of ideas that were influencing Americans at this time. And it's my hope, by bringing an acknowledgement of the Bible's role into the discussion, we end up with a richer sense of the ideas that informed the American founding.
And you do that amazingly well. And come to think of it, you talk about America being a literate society. Everybody's going to be learning to read, and one of the most common books around at the time is going to be the Bible. So it becomes a reference for everybody, whether you're a believer or not. It's there. It's sitting on the table. It's sitting in the schoolhouse. And so you wouldn't be surprised to find out that a lot of people are referring to it and are going to connect with one another in terms of that. So that is one of the great revelations of your book.
That's right. And, you know, one of the ways we know this, by the way, apart from sort of anecdotes and people talking about this in their letters, is we know this from probate records. These are records of the property people leave behind when they died. And the records would indicate that if a family owned only one book in their home, it was almost certainly the Bible. And so this is in almost certainly the most widely owned book in America at this time. And it was a book that was, in its English translation, most widely available in America at the end of the 18th century was the King James Bible. And the language of the King James Bible made it particularly useful as a tool for literacy education. So here's this one book that is in the family's home, and it's a book that is an ideal tool, not only for teaching morals, for teaching certain parables and the like, but it's a very valuable tool in the education of the young, simply learning how to read, how to write.
Now, you mentioned the King James Bible is the dominant version of the Bible sitting around everybody's tables and around the colonies at this time in the United States. You bring up something that I thought was really fascinating. I hadn't thought about this before in your book, but you talk about the rhythm and rhyme, the poetry, the poetics of the King James Bible, and how that had a large influence on the rhetoric at the time as well. So discuss that.
So the history of the English Bible is fascinating, and it's a very important part of understanding our history. So one of the first complete translations of the Bible into the English happens 700-800 years ago with the work of John Wycliffe. In many respects, it's an inferior translation, and it's very hard for us to read today because it's written in that sort of Middle English language. In our more modern times, in the early 1500s, a man by the name of William Tyndale produced a fresh translation of the Bible. I should say he translated the New Testament and was well on his way of completing a translation of the Old Testament when he was, in fact, arrested for his translation work and was martyred. So he didn't actually live to see the completion of an entire new translation of the Bible. And there are a number of other translations that are taking place. Another very important one for purposes of American history was a group of exiles during the reign of Bloody Mary. Exiles living in Geneva produced a Bible known as the Geneva Bible. And this would have been the Bible that the Pilgrims and the Puritans initially brought with them from England. But in the midst of the controversy going on in England between the Puritans and James I and others, a new Bible was produced. It was a Bible that was commissioned by James I, King of England, and this was a King James Bible. It's what we call the King James. It's sometimes called the Authorized Version of the Bible. And this was a Bible that was designed, as were many others, to be read in church. And so there's a language that's being used here that is designed to appeal to the ear as well as to the eye. And there's an elegance, a beauty to the language of the King James Bible. It really is a magnificent work of literature, and I think in many respects explains why this translation has survived for so many centuries. But in this wonderful language, this English language of the King James Bible, there is a kind of a rhythm, a cadence to it that's very distinctive. And I was raised as a young person in hearing the King James Bible. And so often I will hear someone quote from the King James Bible, and without knowing the source, my ear will tell me, just simply based on the rhythm, that this is the language of the King James Bible. It tips me off. And I think this is very significant, because one of the things we've seen with public rhetoric over the course of the last few centuries is that oftentimes speakers will tap into simply the rhythm, the cadences of the King James Bible for rhetorical effect, even though they may not be specifically quoting from the King James Bible. So the best example of this in American history, and Reed talked about this in an earlier podcast, is the Gettysburg Address. The Gettysburg Address rings with the rhetoric, with the rhythms of the King James Bible, even though Abraham Lincoln does not quote directly from the Bible in that speech. So take, for example, the very opening lines of the Gettysburg Address, 67 years ago. It's a rather odd way of saying 87, but it's the way in which the King James Bible oftentimes calculates. We see this, for example, in the 90th Psalm, where the psalmist is speaking of the number of years that man has on this earth, 70. And so Abraham Lincoln, in that very opening phrase of the Gettysburg Address, is tapping into a very rich literary tradition, and he's solemnifying his address by putting his audience in a biblical, and by that I mean a King James version, a biblical frame of mind. And so there's something very distinct, very elegant and eloquent about the language, the English language of the King James Bible.
Yeah, there is that when it comes to the rhetoric, just the cadence and the rhythm of that. But there's also something important about the content of the Bible as well, and you bring this up early in the book, and you call it Protestantism's dangerous idea, and this comes through the rhetoric. What does that mean for America's founding?
Well, so this is takes us back to the Protestant Reformation, this idea that I'm speaking of here, Protestantism's dangerous idea. Since we're speaking here of current events, in 2017 we will be marking the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther nailing those theses to the castle church door, that is oftentimes identified as the event that sparks the great Protestant Reformation. And what I'm suggesting here is that something profound, in terms of our own experience, in terms of our own form of government, is unleashed by those events that transpired in Germany 500 years ago. The Reformation, of course, preached this idea of the priesthood of all believers. All believers are priests. Now, this is a powerful statement, because what's being asserted here is that an individual believer could directly and immediately approach the throne of grace. They could come to God directly and pray to God to communicate with God, thereby removing the priest and the church as an essential mediator between the believer and God. Now, if the Reformation is onto something here, the priesthood of all believers, it then becomes absolutely essential that every Christian know what God actually says in His Word. And so for this reason, many of the early reformers, Martin Luther being a good example, turned their attention very early on in the Reformation experience to translating the Bible into the vernacular language, that is to say, the language of the common man, so that common men could read and know what God says in the Bible. Now, a vernacular Bible doesn't do you a whole lot of good unless you know how to read. And so literacy education becomes a great project of the Reformation. Why? Because you must be able to read to know what God says in His Word, which is being made available to you in the vernacular tongue. Now, once people learn how to read, they develop an appetite for reading. And this unleashes a print culture in Europe. We see an explosion in printed newspapers, printed pamphlets, printed books. And Europeans, in the wake of the Reformation, developed this profound hunger for information, for knowledge. And so literacy education leads to education more broadly. We see an expansion in the universities and learning more broadly. And this leads ordinary citizens to begin to think, hey, I can think for myself. I don't have to go to the church. I don't have to go to the political establishment figures to tell me what to think or how to think or what the arguments are. I can think on my own. And this is what is meant by this phrase, Protestantism's dangerous idea, that individuals can think for themselves. They don't have to rely on establishment figures to tell them what to think, how to think, and when to think. And this is a powerful, powerful thing. And I'm going to suggest to you, Tony, that this sequence of events, the Reformation, the vernacular Bibles, literacy education, education more generally, is what lays the foundation ultimately for Republican self-government. If you have a well-informed public who's learned to read by reading the Bible, you have developed the twin pillars of self-education. The American founders over and over again said, if you're going to have a system of self-government, the population must be educated and they must be virtuous. And you get that both out of this sequence of events. You have to be sufficiently educated that you make well-informed decisions about how to govern yourself. And you also have to be sufficiently virtuous that you can survive without the external conformity brought to bear by an authoritarian ruler's whip and the rod. And so I'm going to suggest to you that Americans see themselves equipped to engage in this constitutional system of Republican self-government because of the forces unleashed by the Protestant Reformation and the dangerous idea of that Reformation.
And that idea comes through in a lot of the rhetoric during that period of time, especially when you talk about the virtuous nature of the citizenry, but also the virtuous nature of the rulers, of the magistrate, as it might have been called back then. And this is where your book really shines, and I think it's a book that folks should pick up, because in the past, there's been a few historians that have talked about the role of the Bible in the founding era. One of the persons that you come to frequently is Donald Lutz, and he mentions, yeah, the Bible was used a lot. So we know that it was used a lot, but what your book adds to the conversation here is how the book was used a lot. And I think you make a very strong case to say, you know, not just to say it was tossed out there and here's the Bible, so we're a Christian nation, but the question is how substantively it was used in that type of rhetoric. Talk a little bit broadly about the methods in which biblical rhetoric was used in the political language or the political conversation of the day, and then we'll go ahead and move into some more specifics.
Yeah, thank you for that question, because I think one of the most important points that I try to make in the book is this. You can simply count up the number of quotations to the Bible in a individual's speech in their discourse. And there are those who do that. They'll look at a particular founding father and say, look how many times this person quoted the scripture. And my view is that simply counting quotations and citations may tell us very, very little about the role of the Bible, the influence of the Bible on that individual or on the culture of which they were a part. Rather, what we have to look at is how the Bible is used. What purposes was the Bible used for? And so one of the things I try to do in the book is move beyond simply adding up quotations and sort of ordering them in some fashion. And I want to sort of examine how and why the Bible was used. And there are many different uses of the Bible, and we must be attentive to these different uses. I think it's very misleading to read spiritual meaning into a purely literary or political use of the Bible. It is equally misleading to view all uses of the Bible as purely literary or political, because sometimes a political figure used the Bible for a profoundly theological reason. So we have to be attentive to these different uses of the Bible. And one of the chapters in the book, I try to develop a rather simple typology, a way of looking at the different uses of the Bible. And I try to illustrate that with examples that will be familiar to most readers. And I begin by looking at the use of the Bible as a source of figures of speech, of literary allusions, perhaps much like we might use Greek mythology. We use it, the Bible, perhaps for metaphors and the like. And there are many, many examples of that that we find in the discourse of this period. I then talk about how the Bible was used, and we mentioned this just a few minutes ago, how the Bible is used to sort of give weight and authority to rhetoric. If you infuse a speech with biblical language, it can oftentimes give discourse a kind of solemnity, authority, a gravitas, if you will. And again, I think we see the use of Scripture used in this fashion as well. Sometimes the Bible was used to provide models or to set precedents for how we should do things in the here and now. For example, a very, very common theme in the literature of the American founding is this idea that one reads in the history of the Hebrew Commonwealth, as recounted in the books of Moses, in the book of Joshua and Judges, for example, we see a model of republicanism. And this is very powerful to Americans in 1776, because after all, they're embarked on a very ambitious and very challenging project of creating a new government. They are abandoning a monarchy, and they've got to come up with a new system of government. And this idea that God had ordained a republican form of government for the children of Israel was very appealing to them. And so they looked to the Bible to provide a model for republicanism, or at least to reassure them that republicanism is a form of government that enjoys divine favor. They're also looking to the Scriptures, to the Bible, for models of things like separation of powers, of due process of law, and other things. So here's another very different use of the Bible, simply to provide examples of models for what we might do and how we might do things in the here and now. We also find the American founders using the Bible for more theological reasons. They want to understand this concept of providence. They want to understand this idea of a God who intervenes in the affairs of men and nations. How does God lead and direct a people? When and under what circumstances does he intervene in the life of a nation? These were profound questions for a largely Christian culture. And so they're going to look to the Bible, to the stories in the Bible that cast some light on these big theological questions. And so this is another, I think, very different use of the Bible that we find the founders turning to. But again, the key point here is that not all uses of the Bible have the same effect or for the same purpose. We've got to be very attentive to why and how the Bible is being used in discourse.
and that, as I mentioned before, is where this book really shines. You spend the latter half, actually the latter two-thirds of the book or so, giving really great examples of this, where it comes through. And you note that it's not just a random scattering of Bible verses, let's open to a random page and let's say it, but there are certain themes that connect back to certain scriptural passages that really are hammered home many times throughout the rhetoric of that era. And I want to go through some of these here. The first one that you bring up is to talk about a divine purpose for this new nation. You kind of get into the providence method, message that comes through in a lot of the rhetoric, going back to John Winthrop, his famous speech on City on the Hill as the pilgrims are coming across the ocean. And the verse that comes up here is Micah 6:8. And I'll just read this for everybody and I'll let you discuss how this comes through. But in Micah 6:8, it says, "He hath showed thee, O man, what is good, and what doth the Lord require of thee, but to do justly, and to love mercifully, and to walk humbly with thy God." How does that come through in the rhetoric and political conversation of the era?
Well, Tony, this was the first chapter I wrote in the book. And in fact, I wrote this even before I even contemplated the book. I gave a little talk, and I had been struck in my reading of this literature from the American founding era how often we found late 18th century Americans referencing this particular verse from the prophet Micah. And it's a very powerful verse, at least it's very powerful to me. And if I were asked, well, what verses would you expect the American founders to quote? This probably would not be the first verse that comes to mind. And because of that, every time I encountered it in the literature of the founding era, it always stood out to me. And it raised this question, which is one of the questions I ask over and over again in the book, is what is it about this passage from the Bible that appealed to this generation of Americans? What did they hear in this verse that spoke to them in their time and in this predicament in which they find themselves? And I think this is a fascinating verse for why I think it appeals to Americans at this time. Now, in my adult life, I have probably heard a dozen sermons in which this was the primary text for the sermon. And almost every sermon I've heard in my lifetime has viewed this verse as sort of a personal, an individual ethic. This is what God requires of you as an individual, to do justice, to love mercy, to walk humbly with your God. And I think, in fact, there is instruction to that effect in the verse. But if you look at the verse in its broader context, this is a passage, the first eight verses or so of the sixth chapter of the book of Micah, are what theologians sometimes call a covenant lawsuit text, a covenant lawsuit. God has a grievance with his people, the children of Israel. They have departed from him. They have abandoned him, notwithstanding the fact that God has been very merciful to them, has provided them security and safety in their entering into the promised land. Why has his people departed from him? And this is the context in which we read this passage of Scripture. And so it spoke to Americans, I believe, at the end of the 18th century, because it was offering guidance not just to them as individuals, but it was guidance to them as a nation. If they hoped to flourish as a nation, if they hoped to enjoy God's blessing upon them, here is God's instruction on what they must do. I think this is why they find this passage so appealing. In my chapter on this verse, I think the most important example I give is from a letter that George Washington writes in June of 1783. This is a letter that is known by historians as the Circular Letter to the States. And I have sometimes called it George Washington's first farewell address, because essentially what he's doing in this letter, which was written to the governors of the 13 states, is he's essentially giving his farewell as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, and he's anticipating a retirement, a permanent retirement, to Mount Vernon. Now, of course, history turns out differently. He's called out of retirement, serves two terms as president, and gives another farewell address, a much more farewell address. But this is his first farewell address. And in the very last sentence of that address, the very final paragraph, and let's remind ourselves, when Washington writes these words, he thinks this is the final words of advice that he has for the American people. He's expecting to retire, never to return to public life. And what is his parting advice to the American people? He says something to this effect. He says, "Americans, my fellow countrymen, if we ever hope to be a happy nation, to be a prosperous nation, this is what we must do. We must do justly, we must love mercy, and here's his little twist on Micah 6:8, we must imitate the characteristics of the holy author of our religion. In other words, we must imitate the virtues of Jesus Christ." I find that remarkable. He's taking this Hebrew verse and he's delivering it to the American people for a political purpose. He's telling them, if we want to prosper as a nation, here's the advice we have to follow. I find it a remarkable passage in Washington's papers.
It also resonates with a more secular warning to the country as we're building this new nation, this grand experiment. And that's, I think it was James Madison who said, it's a republic if you can keep it. And was that Madison?
I think that's Hamilton.
Hamilton, I'm sorry.
If I remember correctly, yes. But we may both be wrong on this one.
But it's a warning that this grand experiment is going to rely upon not only our connection with God, but a virtuous citizenry. And you bring that up in one of the next chapters that you talk about. And you center on Proverbs 14:34 that comes up frequently again in the political conversation. And to quote Proverbs 14:34, it says, "Righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people." How is this used in the political conversation of the time?
Well, I think it's striking a very similar theme here, is that if we hope to enjoy God's blessing, righteousness is going to be required of us. Not just righteousness as individuals, but righteousness as a nation. This has to be part of our political agendas. What does it mean to be a righteous nation, to be a righteous people? And this is a recurring theme over and over again. And again, it's not simply a text that's being preached from the pulpit, although it is certainly being preached from the pulpit, but it's a text that Americans' political figures, the political leadership, even those that we don't always think of as being the most pious, the most devout, they too are drawing on this same theme. One of the quotes that I draw attention to in the book, and again, this is to my way of thinking, it's a very remarkable quote. And a number of founders said very, very similar things, but the example that I give is from John Adams. John Adams at one point says that the Bible is the most Republican book that was ever written. Now think about that for a second. The Bible is the most Republican book that was ever written. Now, when I pick up my Bible, there's a lot of things that come to mind. There's a lot of descriptions that I would give for this book that I hold in my hand. But I can't say, Tony, that I often say to myself, well, now here's a good Republican book I should be reading. So what is it that John Adams and others, John Dickinson, for example, said almost the same thing and almost the exact same words? Why are they thinking of the Bible as a Republican book? And I think this is a window into their way of thinking about not only the political project that they're involved in at that moment in history, but also the vital and essential role that the Bible plays in that project. The reason why someone like Adams or a Dickinson say the Bible's the most Republican book is it goes back to what are the two pillars, what are the two absolutely essential pillars of Republican self-government. Number one, it's the pillar of an educated populace. People have to be sufficiently well-informed that they can make good decisions about how to govern themselves. Secondly, they must be a virtuous people. They have to have an internal moral compass that will guide them in their decisions about how to govern themselves, and they can shake off the external conformity of the authoritarian rulers whipping the rod. So you have to have an educated populace and a virtuous populace. And I think what John Adams is telling us is that if we're going to have a Republican form of government, we have to be virtuous. And what is the handbook for civic virtue? It's the Bible. It's the Bible that's going to instruct us on what it means to act in an ethical, a moral, a virtuous way. So in that sense, the Bible is absolutely essential to this grand experiment in Republican self-government that we find ourselves in at this moment in American history. And I think that's the insight that helps us understand why the Bible is so important to the founding generation.
And your book does a wonderful job of doing this, because whenever I read these historical texts, I always try to put myself into the context of the characters who are there and the various different characters of John Adams, James Madison, but also the regular common folk. And you can imagine just the people who are trying to establish this government, this new grand experiment, the founding fathers saying, okay, we're going to turn over power to somebody else, we the people. And you can imagine there's some hesitancy there going, you know, we the people, we just saw a bunch of these folks just outside the tavern the other night, and I'm a little bit worried about this. But, you know, we need to emphasize this point of, as you say, an educated populace and a virtuous populace. How can we communicate this? Is there a common language that we can do it? Oh, yeah, it's sitting on our tables. It's the Bible there. The other thing that you bring up, it's not just a virtuous populace that is needed for Republican government, but it's also the leaders. We have to send representatives. We all can't be sitting around the table discussing everything. We need representatives, and we need to be able to trust that those individuals are virtuous as well. And in Chapter 8 of your book, you bring up Proverbs 29:2 to talk about how that verse was used to inform the virtue of the rulers, the magistrate, as it's so called. In Proverbs 29:2, to read that, says, "When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice, but when the wicked beareth rule, the people mourn." How did this play off in the political dialogue of the time?
Well, a common refrain in the literature of the time is that a character of a nation is oftentimes set or determined by the character of its rulers. And so we can't divorce the morality of a nation from the morality of its rulers. Not too long ago, we commemorated December 14th is the day that George Washington died. And I'm reminded of the many, many eulogies and sermons that were preached in the aftermath of his death, a devastating loss to the nation. And this was a verse that was cited over and over and over again, that this was one of the great things that Washington contributed to the nation, was that he was a righteous man. Whether he was an Orthodox Christian or not, really that debate for another day. But in many respects, he was a very righteous man in how he conducted himself. And so this is a common theme in the literature of the time. Now, the way I like to think of this, Tony, is there's a plan A and there's a plan B. in the way in which the founders viewed these things. Plan A was that ideally we would like to have righteous rulers, those who are informed by the virtue, the morality, the ethics of Scripture. We would want our rulers to have implanted within them an internal moral compass that would prompt them to behave in an orderly, decent fashion. But unfortunately, we learn in Genesis chapter 3 that man is a fallen creature. We are introduced to this idea of original sin. And this is a profound and prevalent idea in not only Christian theology, but it is a profound idea in the theological culture of the American founding era. This was a culture that was very much shaped by Reformed theology, and I'm associating this with the theology of a John Calvin. And Calvin emphasized that we are very much fallen creatures. And understanding that, the American founder said, we can't rely on the virtue of our leaders alone. We have to devise a political system that takes into account that humans are fallen creatures and will often behave in ways that abuse their power, that take advantage of others within their community. And so we have to devise a system that understands that and checks that. And if you sit down and you read the Constitution, probably no other theme captures your attention more than this idea of the importance of separation of powers, checks and balances. And why? It reflects this desire to restrain fallen human actors who have been given government authority, so that they can't act out their fallen nature, or they're going to be checked in that endeavor. And so, in a very different way, we're seeing how theology, the theology of the Bible as they read it, is informing the very structures of government that they are creating.
Yeah, it's a very powerful one. I'm a public choice theorist, and we often think about the limits of government and how it can concentrate power and how it needs to be dispersed. And what your chapter brings about there is that, yeah, this the plan B, I like how you put that, plan B was, okay, we want virtuous rulers, but probably not going to get them. So how are we going to restrain that, the fallen human character? And I think that comes across very well in how people use this rhetoric. You hear it a lot in political campaigns. We want to elect the most virtuous person, and we've been through a big, huge election here, and we get all the mudslinging that nobody's really virtuous, and then everybody wrings their hands saying, oh, we must need the most virtuous. But as you bring out here, the founder said plan B. Okay, just in case there's not the most virtuous person elected, here's what we have, some separation of power, some checks and balances. There's a few other chapters in this book that, and we're running out of time here a little bit, I really wanted to visit, but it's the connection between the Bible and liberty. And those are some of the most complicated and difficult chapters to wrestle with, because it deals with the revolutionary era. When is it proper to rebel against authority, and when is it proper to obey authority? And then also the character of liberty, or the metaphor of America as freedom, that shapes our nation. I'm going to save that for another time, and I want to invite you back later, and we could do this for our annual 4th of July podcast, so we'll have you back on that. What I do want you to finish up with, though, is to think about a question that I asked to many of our historians on this program, is that all of this stuff happened some 220-odd some years ago. Why does it matter for us today? What is important that we take from your book to understand our contemporary condition?
Well, I think that the founding generation tapped into some universal, some eternal truths. These are truths that I think we must continue to focus on, continue to grapple with. And these are some truths that we have been talking about here in the last few minutes. They understood, for example, that humankind is a fallen creature that needs to be restrained, that needs to be checked. Interestingly, this is an idea that's going to be challenged profoundly just a few years after the American Revolution and the French Revolution, where there were a number of figures in the French Revolution had a very different sort of anthropology, a view of man as being perfectible. Given the choice between those two visions, I think the American founders got it right. Another truth is, again, that we've been speaking about is the importance of virtue in a system of self-government. We have to be focused on how do we nurture virtue, how do we promote virtue if we're going to succeed as a regime of Republican self-government. Otherwise, we just kind of turn ourselves over to rulers who are going to enforce conformity with their desires through the whip and the rod. I think another very important, very simple, but very profound truth is that liberty cannot be confused with license. A theme that the American founders came back to over and over and over again. In our own time, we oftentimes confuse the two. You know, we think liberty means license. Well, I think that will get us in a lot of trouble. I think the founders quite properly had much important to say on what are the limits on a citizen's obligation to submit to civil government or to obey civil government. And these are principles that we can learn from today. But I think perhaps most importantly is this idea that the founders, I think, understood that religion plays an important, albeit informal, check on citizens and rulers. It provides that internal moral compass. And if we remove religion's role in our system of self-government, we have to ask ourselves, what's going to replace it? What's going to replace it? What will prompt us to behave in an orderly, decent fashion? This is a profound question that I think every society, every political community has to grapple with. And this is, I think, among the eternal truths that the founders are discussing, that we have to be discussing in our own time.
Really, really important lessons to be thinking about, especially as we move into the 21st century, and many people say that we are moving toward a more secular republic. These are definitely questions that we do need to address. One more question that I have for you, and I always love to answer or to ask this of my guests. You've been studying this for several decades now. You've really been steeped in it, one of the probably the foremost experts on religion and the founding fathers and the founding era. Is there anything over the course of your studies that has changed your mind on something or really jumped out and surprised you, said, whoa, I never thought I would have expected that?
Yeah. Well, the answer is yes. I'm constantly amazed at things I learn. And one example that I gave earlier in this podcast is that I was quite taken aback to find how often the American founders were drawn to a verse like Micah 6:8, right? In the larger sweep of things, I'm constantly amazed at how well-read, how thoughtful, how wise the founding generation was. They created what, to my way of thinking, was an amazing system of Republican self-government, a system committed to the rule of law, and I'm constantly amazed at how thoughtful of a system they created. I'm always surprised how the founders anticipated and to some extent dealt with the same issues we deal with today. I have a section in the book where I talk about a controversy at the end of the 18th century over Bible reading in schools. Right? Now, I thought that was a 20th century problem, right? Well, they were thinking about and debating some of those same issues. They were debating questions about, well, what do we mean by separation of church and state? What does that mean in practice? Does the character, the moral of political leaders matter? They're anticipating these kinds of questions, and as you just noted, we were asking these same questions in our most recent election. So I'm always amazed at how there's nothing new under the sun, I suppose, to quote the scriptures, And they were anticipating, they were trying to devise a system of government that anticipated some of these big questions. And I think in many respects they did a supreme job in the system that they came up with.
Well, you are correct to note that a lot of those questions are eternal, and we didn't get a chance to dive in entirely to your book. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, we left out a couple really important chapters about the relationship between liberty and religious rhetoric in the founding era. And could I ask you to come back and talk about that in July?
I would love to do that, Tony.
We'd love to have you back. My guest today has been Daniel Dreisbach. Daniel, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.